President Joe Biden accuses oil companies of profiting from the war in Ukraine.
Their profits are a windfall of war. A windfall from the brutal conflict that's ravaging Ukraine and hurting tens of millions of people around the globe.
Plus, Vladimir Putin separating the man from the myth.
I think the war in Ukraine is probably the best indication of how that myth that Putin constructed over the past two decades in power doesn't match the reality.
And later in the program, how an actor in Kyiv avoided becoming a starving artist by creating a twist on a classic food dish named for Ukraine's capital. Today is Tuesday, the 1st of November, 2022. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Herman. Despite Russia suspending its participation in the Black Sea Grain Export Agreement, ships continued Tuesday to leave Ukrainian ports with food to ease the world hunger crisis. Three vessels had left Ukrainian ports by midday. One is headed to Germany with 49,000 metric tons of corn. Another departed for Libya with 22,800 metric tons of wheat. And the third has set sail for Morocco with 12,690 metric tons of sunflower meal. 12 ships departed Monday, the most since the program began, according to the United Nations-led Coordination Center. The United Nations, Turkey, and Ukraine have agreed no ships will move on Wednesday. The export deal in July was agreed to by Russia and Ukraine, and brokered by Turkey and the United Nations. Russian President Vladimir Putin has said Moscow's decision to suspend its participation was a response to a drone attack on the Russian naval fleet in Crimea on Saturday. Ukraine has not claimed responsibility for the attack, and it denies using the grain program security corridor for military purposes. The Ukrainian military Southern Command says its forces targeted a Russian stronghold in the region Monday, killing 21 Russian troops and destroying one military vehicle and a mortar. There's no independent confirmation of this. Meanwhile, Russia continues to pound Ukrainian cities with airstrikes via drones and rockets, killing at least four civilians and wounding four others, according to Ukrainian officials. More from Anna Chernikova, reporting from Kiev.
On the 250th day of Russia's full-scale assault on Ukraine, massive missile and drone attacks on Ukrainian cities continue. Overnight into Tuesday, Zaporizhia, Mykolaiv, Dnipropetrovsk, Kharkiv, Sumy and Donetsk regions came under fire. As a result of Monday's attacks on energy infrastructure across the country, a number of Ukrainian cities face mandated scheduled power cuts on Tuesday. The order includes the city of Kyiv. Ukrainian officials say heavy fighting continues in the southern and eastern front lines. Russian forces are getting ready to defend their control of Kherson, while the Ukrainian army has liberated nine more communities in the Luhansk region. Anna Chernikova for VOA News, Kyiv.
As Anna mentioned, the Russian airstrikes disrupted the supply of electricity in Kyiv and other cities. Residents in the capital, Kyiv, also lost their supply of water. Lydia Butska was one of those waiting for as long as an hour to pump water by hand from wells to fill plastic bottles and cans.
You have imagined that your life will change in incorrect way. For example, you have not water, you are afraid that you will not have a gas, that you will have not light, for example, because a half of Kyiv now without light and water. How do you understand how it will impact your life?
Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko said Tuesday afternoon water and electricity supplies have been fully restored. The mayor advised residents, however, rolling blackouts will continue to stabilize the power grid. U.S. President Joe Biden is accusing energy companies of unjustly profiting off the war in Ukraine. Biden, on Monday at the White House, called it outrageous that six of the largest oil companies have made $100 billion in profits in the last 6 months, and that money is going to shareholders and for stock buybacks, not to give motorists a break at the gas pumps, added the president.
The profits are a windfall of war, the windfall from the brutal conflict that's ravaging Ukraine and hurting tens of millions of people around the globe.
If the industry does not lower prices at the pump and increase production and refining capacity, they will face higher taxes and other restrictions, according to Biden. Some opposition Republicans contend the problem is the president, not the industry. Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota tweeted Monday, "Biden is blaming high gas prices on anyone but his administration, with a week to go until the U.S. midterm elections." So much of what is going to happen in Ukraine in the days, weeks, and months ahead depends on the thoughts and actions of Vladimir Putin, the autocratic Russian president. How well do we know him? A good person to try to answer that question is Andrew Weiss, who oversees research on Russia and Eurasia at the Carnegie Endowment, where he is the vice president for studies. He has also served in various policy roles at the National Security Council, the U.S. State Department, and the Pentagon during both Democratic and Republican administrations. And he is the author of the forthcoming graphic novel, Accidental Tsar, The Life and Lies of Vladimir Putin. He joins us now here on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. For those of us who aren't familiar with what a graphic novel is, I take it this is a kind of comic book, for lack of a better term, about the Russian president. And why, with your super serious background, did you take this approach?
I was always a big fan of this genre, and say for the last 30 years or so, there have been a series of graphic novels published that were both imaginative and serious. And so I was thinking that something like this about Putin was long overdue. But what I wanted to do was really reach audiences that might not normally pick up a wonky paper that I write in my day job. And so I was aiming it at a series of different groups of people, people who might just have a deep interest and burning interest in what's going on in the crisis. I was aiming it at my sort of fellow scholarly and policy audiences. And I was also offering it to younger people, to people who were really just curious about Russia.
Can you give us an example of the real Putin that deviates from the image many of us have of this larger-than-life Machiavellian master politician and former KGB officer?
I think the war in Ukraine is probably the best indication of how that myth that Putin constructed over the past two decades in power doesn't match the reality. The myth of Vladimir Putin, as you say, is this Machiavellian figure who really has everything that he's calculating and understanding about the world. And what we've seen in the war is someone who's let his emotions and his impulses run roughshod over what was in his own best interest. The other side of him, which is sort of detailed in the book, is that Putin was not a successful KGB officer. He was someone who basically never really got very far and worked in a part of the KGB which was not where the high flyers would have been. So what I try to show in the book is both how this image of him as the steady, steely intelligence operative was something that was deliberately created at the beginning of his career by the Kremlin. The Kremlin sort of spin doctors as a way of creating a contrast to the disgraced former president, Boris Yeltsin, who was his predecessor and who was obviously an absentee president and unable to execute his duties for long periods of time due to his alcohol abuse. So they created this image to reassure the Russian people that the state was in good hands. And they had done some very funny focus group testing of what would be an ideal leader. And a lot of Russians in the late 1990s, when the country was really running off the rails, said, "We need someone like this guy from the movies." And they basically mentioned a movie character, Stierlitz, who had been the star of a famous Soviet TV miniseries about a deep cover agent who was inside the SS during World War II.
Let's talk for a minute about the clear and present danger. There's a lot of speculation and fear. Putin won't back down. If you back him into a corner and he thinks the war against Ukraine is lost or that he has no way to win, he'll fire off some tactical nuclear weapons. Do you buy that?
We're in a dangerous situation in Ukraine. On the one hand, the Ukrainian people and their military have way outperformed and have done amazing things to push back the Russian invasion. And there's no doubt that they are fighting for their very survival, and they deserve all of our support and our admiration. We are also dealing with a Russian military which is being shredded. And as that military gets more and more desperate, the question is, what will Putin do? And as you said at the beginning of our conversation, we don't know, because we can't get inside his head. What we do know is that the Russian government tends to rely on escalation as a tool. And there are not so many great tools available to them. They can maybe launch more cyber attacks. They can do things below the threshold of armed conflict. We saw that with the mysterious attack on the Nord Stream pipelines. We've seen that with the attack on the German railway network. And then the question is there anything that can be done on the battlefield that might totally set the Ukrainians back on their heels? I'm not sure that using a tactical nuclear weapon would accomplish that goal, because I don't think the Ukrainians would somehow lay down their arms and basically agree once again to be ruled by Moscow. But what the Russians want is they want Western leaders and publics to be so panicked about this possibility that Western leaders will push the Ukrainians to lay down their arms. And I think, again, that is a fundamental misreading of the agency of the Ukrainian people and their military to defend themselves. And they're not proxies of the United States. They're not the cat's paw of the United States. They are an independent nation that's fighting for its survival.
Andrew Weiss with the Carnegie Endowment and author of the graphic novel out on November 8th, titled Accidental Tsar, The Life and Lies of Vladimir Putin. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Herman. Specialists with the United Nations Nuclear Power Agency on Tuesday inspected a pair of sites in Ukraine that Russia alleged, without evidence, are connected to plans by Ukrainian authorities to set off radioactive dirty bombs. International Atomic Energy Agency Director General Rafael Grossi says the inspections for evidence of a so-called dirty bomb requested by Kiev would be completed soon. French President Emmanuel Macron was in Kiev on Tuesday. He met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who said they made specific decisions on strengthening Ukraine's defense capabilities and on initiatives to restore destroyed energy infrastructure. The European Union is also exploring ways to help Ukraine's energy sector. EU Energy Commissioner Kadri Simson, during a visit to Kiev on Tuesday, tweeted that after witnessing the scale of destruction in Ukraine firsthand, she is making all efforts to increase financial, technical, and practical help. The assistance, according to Simson, will have to come from EU institutions, member states, international partners, and private donors. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in late February, there has been an increase in efforts by the West to transmit factual information to people in Russia and surrounding countries. This program is one example of that, along with expanded programming in Russian and Ukrainian by the Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, the BBC, and others. And Moscow itself is also more assertively pushing its narrative through traditional, social, and digital media. It has echoes of the Cold War era, when Washington and Moscow battled to influence people around the world in an ideological contest. One person who knows a lot about this is Mark Pomer, Senior National Security Fellow at the Clements Center of National Security at the University of Texas, Austin. He is also a former RFERL Russian Service Assistant Director and was Director of VOA's USSR Division. Mark has now written a book called Cold War Radio, The Russian Broadcasts of the Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. He joins us now on Flashpoint Ukraine. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Mark, so much has changed, and some things seem to have not since the Cold War era. I would first like to get your assessment on whether you see the West now effectively countering the disinformation coming out of Russia regarding its war against Ukraine.
Well, I think that our task in the 1980s, when I was at the Voice of America, was much easier than it is today. the Soviet Union in the late 70s and 80s, communism was dying in the Soviet Union. I remember being told this by various dissidents and various refuseniks, Jews who couldn't emigrate. They said, look, communism is just not an ideology that is going to animate Soviet citizens. They're not going to fight for it. They're not going to die for it. But they told me, and it's a very important but, they said, Russian nationalism, Russian imperialism is making headway, especially in the Soviet military, in the KGB, more of the sort of police structures of the state. And there, people are looking not to promote communism, they're looking to promote a great Russia. And what we're seeing today is really, in many ways, that expression, almost a full expression, with Mr. Putin's grievances that really echo those very same things, that we were a great country and now we're not. We have to assume that greatness again. So I think the task for us was easier because a large part of the population in the Soviet Union at that time was really looking to the West for real information. They had grown tired of theirs. They understood that there were lies. They were looking for a different path forward. Now what we're witnessing is kind of people buying in to a great Russian narrative. Who does Putin identify himself with? Peter the Great, with Tsars, with an imperial notion of the state. In this battle that we're in, and you're right, we are in an information battle, we're sort of having a harder time reaching a lot of people in Russia today because they are, I think, blinded, they believe, they've been told, they've accepted a different notion of where Russia is going. And I think that's going to be a very difficult one to reach.
The information war when the Soviet Union existed was fought to a large degree with powerful shortwave transmitters, including Moscow using them to interfere with the signals of VOA and RFERL, a technique known as jamming. These days, much of this battle is occurring in cyberspace. What challenges does that pose for getting information accurately and in a timely manner into Russia?
Well, currently, as I understand it, YouTube is really one of the best ways in which to reach Russians. YouTube has not yet been closed down. I think there are going to be a lot of challenges. It's a matter of the ingenuity of the techies today that are going to be able to work around that. And I'm not in any position to suggest how they should be doing it. But I think the creativity on the part of the West is probably pretty high. And I think if there is a desire on the part of Russians, that's the key. Because you mentioned jamming, that was important. But people went out of their way to get around jamming. They would go outside the cities. They would go to their dachas. They would visit friends in the countryside because the country is so big, you couldn't jam the whole country. You could jam certain areas, certain parts of the city. And when I was a Fulbright scholar back in 1981 in the Soviet Union, and I got to know people and they took me out to their weekend, very, very modest little dachas, little weekend retreats, they would very often turn on either the BBC or The Voice or RFERL, and it came in relatively cleanly, whereas in the city, it would be hard. It was the matter of wanting to get to them. That's the real key. And what risk, that's the other thing, what risk will Russians take to tune in? Because in the Soviet Union, early on, it was a serious crime to listen to foreign broadcasting. By the 1980s, it became fairly lax. And I think people didn't feel that they were going to necessarily either be arrested or lose their job. What happens in Russia today is hard to predict as it's getting more and more dictatorial.
Well, Mark, that leads me to the question of what you are hearing from those Russian friends you've made over the decades. We know many outside the country can speak out freely about the war and against Putin. Any ideas to the extent of dissatisfaction with the war inside Russia right now?
When you have a country and almost a million people leave after mobilization, it's a pretty good sign that there is discontent in the country. But I think in my own personal case, and I've had a relationship with the Soviet Union and Russia for 42 years, beginning in 1973 and ending at the end of 2015. And I know lots of people, I work there for a number of years, and they have gone quiet. They do not write to me. They do not contact me. They are not on Facebook anymore. They're not on social media. So I think there's been this Iron Curtain, or maybe it's not an Iron Curtain anymore, maybe a digital curtain, I don't know what the right metaphor would be, but has come down. And among old Russia hands, we're all discussing how far back has today's Russia gone? Has it gone back to Brezhnev, or has it gone back even earlier? Are we approaching Stalin's time? And if so, what are going to be the consequences? But the country is becoming ever so much cut off. And a country that certainly after communism, that is becoming more and more of a problem. And I think that in the long term is going to be a serious problem for the world, is going to be a serious problem for Russia.
Mark Pomar, one of our former VOA colleagues and presently hanging his hat in Austin, Texas at the Clements Center for National Security. Thank you for your insight today, Mark.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. It's a delight to be on VOA.
An actor in Kiev, Ukraine's capital, has not let the war and the resulting lack of work turn him into a starving artist. Alexander Avakumov teamed up with others to open a fast food restaurant in the city's downtown. Their Chicken Kiev eatery is one of the many new businesses in Ukraine since the Russians invaded the country. The story from Anna Kostuchenko in Kiev.
From the age of six, Alexander Avakumov knew that he wanted to be an actor. But as with many actors, getting a break was more about persistence than just talent.
I worked as a journalist, as an editor, as a model, even as a doorman. But finally, I told myself, if I want to start acting, I have to do it now. I started like everybody else, with auditions and lots of no's from film directors before I heard the first yes.
In 2017, Avakumov got his first role in a Ukrainian TV series and has been working ever since. When Russia invaded Ukraine, Avakumov was working on a new Ukrainian film that immediately stopped filming. He took his wife and young son abroad, then returned to Kyiv to do volunteer work at the front lines.
My friends and I decided we won't run.
Even though Russian forces left the Kyiv region, the film industry is still mainly dormant. So Avakumov had an idea for a new business, a risky endeavor during a war, but he thought opening a new eatery would pay off.
I don't know what will happen to my acting career now, but I felt entrepreneurship was something I had been preparing myself for my whole life.
Avakumov and his partners decided to open a new restaurant offering one of the culinary symbols of Kyiv, Chicken Kyiv, but with all kinds of variations on a theme.
We opened on August 24th, Ukraine's Independence Day. We wanted to do something very Ukrainian, very modern and homey at the same time.
Local residents have fallen in love with the new takeaway, Avakumov says. And despite the weather getting colder, people are still lining up for this hometown delicacy.
A co-worker recommended it to me. Chicken Kyiv with Philadelphia and spinach. We found out about this place on Instagram and decided to come by and try it. I went with the classic one, then we'll taste other types.
Avakumov says they plan to expand and their business has become a part of the struggle against Russian occupation.
We're known as an unbeatable nation. I believe that one day Chicken Kyiv will become a brand worldwide. We could even open a place in Manhattan.
Avakumov is not the only one to have started a business amid the war. According to the Ukrainian National News Agency, some 150,000 new businesses have been registered in the country since the start of Russia's invasion. Anna Kostuchenko for VOA News, Kyiv, Ukraine.
That's all for today's show. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on our social media platforms, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Chief National Correspondent, Steve Herman. Have a good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.